And in effect, the space didn't exist, but Fort Douglas, which was on near the campus of the university, and in fact the campus of the university was established on what had been a part of Fort Douglas, and as now the university has taken over all the rest of Fort Douglas over a series of accretions as the army was persuaded to give up the idea that they were going to stop fighting the Indians, there would be some buildings available and that things would be established. Well, as I said in my thing, if I had gone out to look at this, I would have been so discouraged I wouldn't have accepted the job, which would have been a mistake, because as the fact is, we used the temporary building and we were able to order all the equipment and supplies and everything else, and eventually we got a good building for all of this. But it took 5 months. In those 5 months, I wrote up all the stuff I had done in Utah, and one paper even left over from the Rockefeller Center.
And did you start teaching at this
point? And I started teaching immediately. Utah was still on the accelerated program with the idea that since the people who had gone through medical school during the war had gone through in 3 years, here were the returning veterans who should have the opportunity of acceleration as well. So in effect, we were doing a rather accelerated kind of teaching program, and I started to teach in the course. And we started to accumulate some graduate students, so I was teaching in the medical course, and I was teaching a graduate course in entomology, and a graduate course in protein chemistry. It was great fun. I had to learn all of these things over again, and one good way of learning it is to teach it. Mm-hmm. I'm going to go get a drink of water.
Sure. How did your wife feel about moving to Utah from the East Coast?
Well, she was well aware of the fact from the time, even before we were married, that you decide to lead an academic life, it's a migratory profession. That not all the people who get their degrees at any institution can possibly stay there. In fact, the policy in general very often is not to have anybody stay, but to bring people from the outside. And so she was well aware of this. Of course, our families thought we were moving God knows where, out among the Indians, obviously. This was a very remote part of the world. But she had no hesitation whatsoever. And she knew that while I had my satisfactions in industry, such as they were, that I was not completely happy in this industrial environment. It was not that I was bitterly unhappy, don't misunderstand me. It was not that I resented it, anything. And during the war, it was certainly better than being the alternative being drafted. After all, I was kind of free wassailman every year. I was called up all the time, and each time the company had to intervene, and the last time it finally was stopped by the president of the company talking to Roosevelt's personal physician to stop that the blood program was not going to flourish or continue if I were drafted. Besides which, they even resented the fact that I had to take a day off every time the draft board called me, because you had to report to your old draft board, which was in New York. So that was the end of that. In some ways, if I had been drafted, I would have been probably down in Bethesda, because if there were danger of my being drafted and if the company couldn't get a deferment, what would happen is that I would have gone into the Navy Medical Service, because they were responsible for this whole program, and I knew more about most of the people down in Bethesda anyhow, because I was actually in it.
Let's see. Okay. You were also joined by Douglas Brown shortly after, who worked with you at SWIP, I guess the next year?
He came out about 6-8 months later. Doug had been a technician at SWIP, whom I had hired and taught how to run the Tesalius electric apparatus. and to do certain other routine measurements at Squibb. Of course, every batch of protein that we prepared, particularly albumin, had to be examined in the electrophoresis apparatus to make sure it contained not more than 2% of purity. Had to be a minimum of 98% albumin. Most of it was obviously better than that. And other things had to be characterized. Well, Doug had been drafted into the Navy or volunteered in the Navy and had received a medical discharge, I guess around 43 or 44, because he'd had a tumor on his foot, which was taken off and his heel was shortened. In any case, he received the medical discharge looking for a job instead of going back to finish up college. And when he found out that I was going to Utah, asked whether there might be a job for him, because what he would like to do was work part-time or full-time and finish up his college education and then decide what he wanted to do. He needed the equivalent of about another year and a half of college work. And I said I'd think about it and see what the possibilities were, and before I left, I was able to tell him, yes, we would have a Tiselius electrophoresis apparatus, we would have other kinds of physical apparatus, and that he could take a couple of courses each day, as long as the time were made up, either in evenings or weekends, he would have a full-time job. So as soon as we had the labs installed and the equipment arrived, then Doug came out with his wife and about a six-month-old baby or something like that. And he stayed with me there from 1946 until 63, and then moved with me here until I retired in 1978.
It's a long relationship.
That's right. And he stayed on for another few years and then decided he was too spoiled, he didn't want to work for anybody else, and took early retirement.
That's a long period of time to have one person continue in that position.
That's right. But he, person who's good with his hands, he's a superb photographer, he's a superb amateur photographer who's won a lot of prizes, very active in the photographic societies locally, and very good with his equipment of all kinds and maintenance as well as running it, but didn't feel that he had the stuff to go through a PhD and didn't want to do the book learning. You'd rather watch the movie or watch television or go to a game or something else. There are different kinds of people in this world. And of course it was very good for me, because this relationship lasted for, as my research assistant, essentially 32 years. Not at Squibb, of course, he was working for me, but there was a little more indirect relationship. And I put his name on a large number of papers over the years. I never counted up how many, but probably there are 30 or 40 papers where his contribution was sufficiently substantial to justify putting his name on the paper.
It's very impressive. Well, he must have been an impressive person to continue.
Still is. We're very good friends. We see each other all the time. They live over in the San Fernando Valley, about half hour away from us.
Rather than at this point talking about some of the research that you were doing, and well, a lot of that's been summarized in review articles, and you categorized it very nicely in that essay. And I do want to talk briefly about some aspects of that, but I thought maybe at this point we could pursue your experiences at Utah and also your move here before we went to look at that, some of the research aspects of, as you have said, sort of followed more, had a more logical sequence than they did in your earlier career. That from the Utah period on, things are more in keeping with the times, I think, you said, something like that, in terms of the research development.
Well, the point is, I think what I meant by that, I'm trying to remember the context in which I said it, because after all it's now a good 10 years ago since I wrote that, I guess. The point is that each successive new tool that came along got added to the armamentarium of every biochemist, protein chemist. In the 1920s, there were very few laboratories in this world that had a good spectrophotometer. By 1950, everybody had a good spectrophotometer. In 1934, very few people had a Warburg manometer. By 1950, Warburg manometers were out of date. There were very few Warburg manometers around. They had become commonplace and succeeded by something else. We got analytical ultracentrifuge number two. Within 10 years, every major laboratory in the world had an analytical ultracentrifuge and preparative ultracentrifuges. When Stein and Moore started to develop their amino acid analysis and their automatic machines, they were, of course, the first. But within a couple of years, when Beckman started to make them, everybody had. We had the first ones, by the way, because the automatic amino acid analyzer was devised by Stein and Moore with the help of my former graduate student, Darrell Spackman, who was good with his hands, and I sent there for exactly that reason. So we had the first commercial machines. So if you were in protein chemistry, one had to take on every new method and every new piece of equipment, and that's what stimulated the progress. We knew what to do from an ideological viewpoint. We all had the viewpoint of what we needed. We needed amino acid analysis. We needed accurate molecular weights. We needed accurate amino acid analysis. We needed methods of doing sequence determinations. We needed then later mechanisms of doing three-dimensional structures. We needed methods of analyzing proteins. We needed methods of purifying proteins. As each method came along, every laboratory that was in the know immediately had to take advantage of it. And we were in the fortunate period of time when the NIH had the money to give away for all of this. And this is what led to spectacular progress, in essence, in the whole field of biochemistry and protein chemistry, and now in nucleic acid chemistry. So that when I say that the progress became that of the times, this, I think, is what I meant by it. Whereas before, one may have had some unique ideas or unique things that were available, but that didn't last very long. In this period, everything is known by everybody almost instantaneously. And the culmination of it is that whereas the ASBC, as it then was, when I would give a talk on proteolytic enzymes, or for that matter in some aspects of protein chemistry, there would be one small afternoon session late in the week devoted to that subject. Protein chemistry today is a very substantial part of biochemistry, and we now have a protein society, of which I acted as one of the obstetricians to help it give birth a few years ago. And as my wife now says, I'm a neonatologist now, helping to keep it going. But it doesn't need me anymore. They keep me around out of goodwill because I helped in the beginning. These young people realize that we need to have a smaller society to deal just with the integrative aspects of all of protein chemistry. Because protein chemistry is no longer chemistry. It's physical chemistry, it's immunology, it's physics, it's everything in the world. And the physicists who are in protein chemistry will not go to the ASBMB meetings. And the biochemists are not going to go to the crystallography meetings. So you have to have a place to bring them together. And this is what's happened. But this has been the strength of modern biochemistry. And if I may dilate on this philosophy of mine for 1 minute, I'll give you an anecdote. In the early 1950s, or late in the 1950s, the NIH decided to set up training grants. Up to that time, they had been giving awards for pure research grants. And they had also established a fellowship program and a pre-doctoral fellowship program, postdoctoral and pre-doctoral. This, in effect, was getting too cumbersome. The idea that people are going to try to evaluate every pre-doctoral applicant from all over the country, postdoctoral applicants, was beginning to get out of hand. And the notion was to establish training grants so that leading institutions would get the support to train graduate students or postdoctoral fellows and let them do the selection in terms of their own standards. Why should NIH bother with this? I was asked to serve on the first committee of training grants for the entire spectrum of NIH activities. Clearly, this was just the beginning. And after that first year, it broke up into sectional affairs. So I was one of the first members of the training grant committee on biochemistry. And one of the things the NIH asked us to do was set up criteria as to what represented a good graduate training program in biochemistry. And those of us who were on the committee, and I guess there were 10 of a dozen of us at the time sitting there, and it started to go around the table and people said, well, a beginning graduate student certainly ought to have courses in organic chemistry and physical chemistry, one kind of thing, on and on. And what the contents of the courses ought to be. And suddenly in the middle of this, I burst out laughing. And Herb Carter, who was chairing it, said, something's bothering you. And I said, yes, what's bothering me, Herb, is the fact that there are only two people on this committee out of a dozen who have degrees in biochemistry. And this is the strength of biochemistry. Herb Carter and Al Enninger were the only two people on that committee who had actually gotten a PhD in the field of biochemistry. All the other people there had come from biology, or from organic chemistry, or from physical chemistry. Dave Rittenberg had been a student of Harold Urey in physical chemistry, somebody else had been in organic. And this all around the table. I said, the whole strength of this science has been the diversity of people who came into it with different technical and intellectual backgrounds, and that is what has made us. And that's what has got to continue to make us, and I think that we ought to let every department of biochemistry set its own criteria. And if they've got a bright student who has learned a lot of physics but doesn't have much organic chemistry, I'd say take them. Let's cut out the nonsense of dictating what course contents ought to be. That was the end of that discussion. And I think this is what I mean by what is in keeping with the times. And this is still true today. There is a swing over now into a more biological and biochemical kind of approach with less organic chemistry and perhaps even less physical chemistry, except on the part of the X-ray crystallographers and the NMR specialists and all the people who are getting into it from that end. Doesn't matter. The pendulum will swing in terms of the way the fields change and the way what methods become available. Up until now, or up until very recently, X-ray crystallography was the only way of doing three-dimensional structure. Now NMR can do 100 residues in a protein. There's a paper in this month's PNAS or someplace, or no, it's in this week's Science, where they're talking about being able to get up into the 150, 200 residue range with NMR, which is a lot cheaper once you have the equipment, and you don't need all that much equipment and take less time. But all this is made possible by high speed computers. If we didn't have the computers, we couldn't do anything today. And this is the way it's going to go. So when I say I was in keeping with the times, and that also brings me to another aspect of this, because we're not going to go on too much longer, I won't have any voice left. I decided when I retired I was going to retire and give up a lab, because in effect the kind of methods that I was using to do protein structure were becoming antiquated, and that if I were to stay active as a biochemist with any interest in doing what I was doing, or anybody else having any interest in seeing what I was doing, I would have to re-gear the lab 100%. Every method that I was using, some of which we had developed, was now being superseded, was so much easier, was so much different, I would have to start all over again. And there was no point to it. I'd had 50 years in a lab, that's enough. And the fact is that you have to know what, to have a perspective on how the science is developing. And today, people are doing amino acid sequences of proteins by isolating the DNA, by isolating a little bit of the protein, getting a small part of the sequence, attaching that to something else, making an antibody, using the antibody to fish out the section of DNA on which this protein is being made, cloning it, getting the DNA sequence, checking it to make sure that it's the right thing and you've got the whole damn sequence in short order with very little labor, but with a whole new set of techniques that are partially biological, partially chemical. Well, this is a different world. But first we have to get the techniques for doing the sequence. First we have to prove that you could do all of this and that it made sense to do all of this. And this is a different world. And I don't have to compete in this world any longer. I competed in other sets of worlds earlier and let the young people have this. So that's essentially my philosophy behind this.
How quickly did Utah develop since you started there when it was brand new virtually?
Well, it had been going as a four-year school for about 2 years when I came, and it developed very well. It's had its bumps, like other places, and the first big hurdle in the early years was surmounted thanks to the NIH. The grant policy was generous, and the NIH, like all government agencies, likes the geography of the United States. They like to put some money every place so that you get the support from the House of Representatives and the Senate. And we were the only medical school in what was called the Intermountain West. Between Colorado and the West Coast and between Canada and Mexico, we were the only medical school at that time.
Yeah.
Since then, there are schools in Arizona, there are schools in New Mexico, and there's no school yet in Wyoming, too small. There's no medical school in Idaho. There are now new medical schools in the Dakotas. There's no real medical school in Nevada, tiny place. They don't have the population for it. So that in a sense, and Utah signed agreements, of course, with all of these states to take in their students. So the NIH was anxious to see this develop. You need the support of the West if you're going to get legislation through. We were the beneficiaries. We were the beneficiaries. I make no bones about it, it's real. But the school grew, the quality grew, and old people retired, new people came along. Every school makes mistakes in appointments, but they make a lot of good appointments. And today it's really flourishing well, particularly since they've gotten the local support. They've got good new buildings, good new facilities, good library. Jim Fletcher, as president, did a good job when he was there. You know, he later went to NASA, back to NASA. And I think it can continue. They've made mistakes. They've had a current president who is retiring next week, who made some disastrous mistakes with cold fusion. But the school will recover.
You made an interesting comment, and I picked up on what you just finished before, that when you arrived there, you were young yet, and you were new, and there were other new people coming in, yet there was, an old guard present. How did that interaction take place? Did any of the old guard adjust to the new changes, or were they...
Well, some of the old guard, I think, resented. But most of them didn't. We had one man in biochemistry named Goldthorpe who had been the professor and chairman of the department when it was a two-year school. He was a very nice man. He had done some old-fashioned nutrition research, you know, 50, 60 years before. He had been teaching practically alone with the help of one assistant for years. There was no opportunity for research. He didn't resent it. He didn't resent it. We got along very well. And we gave him things to teach that were within his ken. But clearly, he was not going to teach modern enzymology or protein chemistry or that kind of thing. This was a different kind of story. So that within the Department of Biochemistry, he was really the only one. The others were all people who had come after it was established as a four-year school. In the clinical departments, of course, there had been nobody. Because the two-year school, except for pathology, didn't have any clinical departments. And the first head of the clinical department was surgery, and he was responsible for bringing Max Wintrobe out in medicine, and then a whole series of other people came in. I wasn't there at the time, but of course I knew it. Let's remember that at that time, there were something like 70 medical schools in the United States. There were now about 130.
That's a double in the last
50 years.
Or 50 years.
Almost, let's say almost 50 years, because they're not going to be anymore.
Fascinating. That's quite a change. I hadn't thought about that. Boy, when you double it in that period of time.
Well, some of them had been two-year schools that got to be four-year schools. Well, look at California. California, before the war, had University of California, San Francisco, University of Southern California, and the College of the Medical Evangelists over in San Bernardino. University of California alone now has, you know. Just,